for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama's push for health care reform has set off an intense debate over how best to treat and insure Americans and the role of government in our lives. The health care debate joins a growing list: bank bailouts, stimulus packages, financial regulations, just to name a few, where Americans and their elected leaders struggle to find the proper balance of government in their lives. Joining me here in the studio, Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, former FCC General Counsel Bruce Fein, and the Pew Research Center's Andrew Kohut. We are expecting the Wall Street Journal's Stephen Moore. Apparently, there is a huge traffic tie-up here in Washington because of some suspected package. But we will hope to see him shortly. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
I wonder, Andy Kohut, if you could give us an idea of what some of the latest polls are indicating about the way Americans feel about their government.
Well, this debate about health care reform and then the economic stimulus programs of Bush and then Obama previously has raised the issue of government and brought it into a higher profile than it had been for a long time. That's clear. What we had seen in the early part of this decade, in the middle part of this decade in particular, was that the public becoming a little more receptive to government. And we saw the era of less anti-government attitudes than was prevalent in let's call it the Gingrich era. But since the election, we've seen more people say they're interested in a smaller government that produces does fewer things than a larger government. I'll just give you the numbers. In the election, at the election time, the public was divided 49-47 in favor of big government versus small government. By April of this year, it was 48% saying we prefer a smaller government. And I think there's obviously a little backlash going on as people worry that the Obama administration and the Bush administration had gone too far in evaluating the prominence of government. And certainly concerns about government are central to opposition, general opposition to the health care plans that are being considered by the Congress and by President Obama.
Bruce Fein, you're a lifelong Republican. What role do you believe the federal government should play? What do you believe the role the federal government is playing? How is that affecting people's outlook?
Let me begin, if I can, with a brief snapshot about the history of the United States and whether the U.S. Constitution says anything about this issue. And we had a similar debate, I guess, at the very first Congress establishing the first bank of the United States. Was that too much government intrusion? And then we had the old debate about internal improvements and then land-grant colleges and whether the Federal Reserve Board created in 1913 and the whole issue of the New Deal raised this issue again. So this isn't a question of whether the Constitution ordains one result or another. It's up to us as the people to decide, and it's not a place where you get a punctuation that's a period and you don't continue to go on. Now, my view, Diane, is that the role of the federal government here is to provide a safety net for those who are generally physically, mentally handicapped. They can't make it on their own. They also have an obligation, in my judgment, to provide education. That's the opportunity that everyone is entitled to make it on their own. It's what Abraham Lincoln said, a fair chance in life, irrespective of race, gender, sexual orientation, religion, or otherwise. After that, I'm dubious, other than the actual national defense that the United States has to provide. They have to preserve our sovereignty. I don't think that that history shows that when the government gets involved in programs, it becomes politicized. It's not meritocracy. It's who has the political clout, whether it's the farmer lobby one day or the bankers the next. You know, the bonuses, to me, just shocking. People having foreclosures and Merrill Lynch getting $6, $7 billion in bonuses because politicians respond to political incentives, not to economic ones. And that's, in my judgment over the long haul is not well advised for the United States. We get our definition as a people because of our industry and ambition, our ability to make it on our own with the government there if we are, we're crippled for circumstances outside our control. But I certainly recognize that's not the only way that the Constitution permits, and we need to continue to struggle with this issue.
Elmer Clift, it's not just that government is being accused of lots of waste and fraud. You have seen at these raucous town meetings, at these tea parties, people speaking out saying they are not being pushed by any conservative faction. They are speaking out because they think government has gone awry. What's happening?
Well, these attitudes that are erupting are certainly being fueled by politicians who see merit in it for their political advantage. And it seems to me that the same people who decry government excesses, why not ask them about corporate excesses? And we saw that in spades beginning last fall, and the bonuses and things that Bruce was talking about. So I think problems are not exclusive to the federal government. But there is an anger building out there. It reminds me, actually, of 1992 when Ross Perot emerged on the scene to really carry the message about a deficit that was out of control. And he actually had political power because he helped drive the agenda of President Clinton, who came in immediately with a budget. He didn't get any Republican votes, but he raised taxes and began to put our fiscal house in order. So there is political energy and power behind what we're seeing. And I think if the Democrats don't pay attention to it, it will be at their peril. But I think we should also remind ourselves that the attitudes towards government is basically the dividing line between the two parties ideologically. If you go back to President Reagan in his inaugural address when he said government is not part of the problem, not part of the solution, it's part of the problem. Then the whole notion of states' rights, which has been held out by the Republican Party, which was anti-federal government as well. And Democrats have also had a field day running against government. And in fact, Barack Obama ran against the lobbyists and the politicians who were beholden to them. And Howard Dean said that he represented the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And so this is part of our political DNA, is to rail against the government. But I think there are some things only government can do. And they do things at least as well as the private sector.
Elmer Clift, she's contributing editor for Newsweek. Bruce Fine, former associate deputy attorney general, Republican counsel during the Iran-Contra hearings, founding partner with the Litchfield Group. Andrew Kohut is director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. I do invite your calls, questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We hear over and over and over the government is taking over healthcare. The government has been involved in healthcare for decades. So why is this theme resonating, Andy?
Well, if you look at opinions about government over the years, we don't find what we had in the 60s, where most people said in surveys that they trust the government to do the right thing all the time or most of the time. Back then, you could get the public to willingly say, I'll go along with Medicare, that the proposals for Medicare, that the government would come out of Social Security taxes and would be a government-run program. But since the end of the 60s and into the 70s, 80s, and ever since, most people say they don't trust the government. The 60s were a lesson for many Americans about government. It disillusioned them with government. Now, it's really important to understand, though, that the public is not does not take a hard ideological position on this. Republicans and conservatives do, but independents and many moderate Democrats are willing to change their minds based upon individual situations. Most people say that it was a good idea that the government was exerting more control over the economy early in this year. As Bruce said, every year that we have conducted surveys since the late 80s, 63% say it's the responsibility of the government to take care of people who can't take care of themselves. We have an ebb and flow of concerns about government based upon issues and based upon the politics of the moment. The politics of the moment at this point are pretty tough when it comes to views about government.
I think, Diane, that there's much more consensus between the two parties, much to my chagrin, than has perhaps been indicated. That is, the Chamber of Commerce was fully in favor of the bailout for the corporations, although they clamor against other government subsidy programs. President Nixon imposed wage and price controls, perhaps the most comprehensive government intrusion in everybody's life, you know, in my lifetime. Every wage, every price was subject to some prices are in Washington, D.C. And with regard to the bailout in general, that was President Bush and John McCain came back specially to vote for. Now, you could quibble between $780 billion stimulus and $850, but that's not a difference in principle. And it's really, and it's not unusual you find people with contradictory ideas in their mind at the same time. People in general can say, I don't like government. They don't want their check taken away. Take the, one of the most conservative elements would be the farming community. They're the ones who are most vocal about keep those subsidies coming for not planting crops.
So they're supporting government
absolutely.
Action.
As long as it helps them. It's just they don't want to help somebody else.
Bruce
it's quite
Fine, Elner Clift, Andrew Kohut. We are expecting Stephen Moore of The Wall Street Journal shortly. We'll take your call. Stay with us. And welcome back. Three people are here in the studio. Elner Clift of Newsweek, Bruce Fine, former Associate Deputy Attorney General, Andrew Kohut, Director of the Pew Research for People and the Press. We are expecting Stephen Moore of the Wall Street Journal. Here are a couple of tweets. This one, isn't this really about corporate control versus the people of the U.S.? The government should be us. Corporations are not people. Elner.
Well, it seems to me that progressives and those who want health care reform could have made the case that the insurance companies are taking over and that the government needs to bolster its role in the marketplace in order to keep the insurance companies at bay. But that argument wasn't made, or at least it wasn't made effectively. But listening to what Bruce said about the farmers wanting theirs and everybody wanting theirs, self-interest is the thread that runs through here. And there's also a self-interest that's political. And President Reagan ushered in 30 years, really, of the dominance of conservative ideology and conservative thought. And he built it around this role of a smaller government. I mean, you could argue he didn't really follow through. He did. He built plenty of big government himself, but the perception was that he was reducing government. And President Obama has come in basically restoring the FDR mantra that the government needs to help solve these problems, and that we're at a crossroads and we have all these enormous problems, from climate change to education system that's suffering to infrastructure. And he's trying to be a transformative president across all of these issues and using government. If he gets it right, he will usher in 30 years of the dominance of this liberal progressive thought. And so those are the political stakes. I mean, I think the two parties are fighting for their survival here.
All right. And joining us now is Stephen Moore of The Wall Street Journal. I gather you got caught up in a massive...
Diane, I'm a new advocate of public transit after what happened this morning.
There was a package.
All the major arteries to get here were closed down, so it was gridlock. But I was listening to the show on the radio, and it's a pleasure to be here. I think, you know, I wrote this piece in the Journal yesterday about some of these polling data that show now the average American thinks about 50 cents of every dollar that's sent to Washington is wasted. And I think part of the...
Let me stop you right there. Is that true?
I used to work at the Gallup organization in 1980. 50% was 50 cents wasted per dollar was exactly what we got in
actually. Well, I looked at the historical data that this was the highest, and I talked to the Gallup people. They said this was the highest they'd seen in 30 years. Well, but it is true that you see these things go up when there's unrest with government.
But it's the belief that 50 cents of every dollar is wasted. What is the truth?
Well, there's also the belief that we ship massive amounts of our federal treasury
to the foreign
countries that don't deserve it.
Right.
When it's, I believe, it's less than
1%.
1%.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So,
well, my point is that this is just a barometer of people. It's a pretty good barometer, regardless of, you know, how much is really wasted. I think that you can track this number over time, and you can see that when there's unrest with what's happening in this town, that number goes up. And I think it's a result of the fact that we've seen such an enormous increase in government involvement in the last year. All the bailouts, the $800 billion stimulus plan, the cash for clunkers, all the talk about a government-run healthcare system. And, you know, just two things that happened in the last week, I think, you know, really tie into this. One was the Acorn scandal, where, you know, this is a company that is corrupt, that gets, you know, several hundred million dollars a year in government money. And the other was there was just a vote yesterday on the Senate healthcare bill. And the amendment was brought up about posting the bill 72 hours so that people could read it on the internet before it's voted on. And the Democrats voted that down. They didn't even want – this was supposed to be the new era of transparency and openness and sunshine. And the press said, no, we don't want people to be able to read the bill 72 hours. So my point is I just think there's a kind of feeling that – of kind of arrogance in Washington, that they're not listening to the people. And this is the reason that I think people are – coming to the Washington Mall, and you see these protests.
Bruce Vaughn.
Well, I think there's no doubt that when there's an economic contraction and people find their lives a little more difficult, they look for scapegoats, if you will. Just scream and yell whether or not it's well-founded. And if you want to talk about, you know, government involvement, say the wage and price controls, if Nixon was the most intrusive ever, he was reelected. It was President Bush, George W. Bush, who proposed the expansion of the drug program for the seniors. Mm-hmm. And this is an issue where people are hypocritical. They just scream and yell, somebody else's dollars wasted, but theirs is good. And it's not always corporations. The labor unions go get the tariffs or the limitations on Chinese imports. The AARP is a very powerful lobby. And what we've come to is a custom of just shifting to future generations the responsibility for paying for our debts. $1 trillion, you know, now becomes routine. And I do not believe that this is a sharp ideological divide. It is true, as Eleanor points out, the language changes. I was there with Reagan. The taxes cut, but the program stayed the same.
The taxes were called revenue enhancers.
Okay, but whatever happened, but the government programs right. did not disappear.
No.
They didn't disappear under Clinton. When Gingrich wanted to shut down the government, he lost his battle with Clinton.
Ask
he didn't win it.
One question about Acorn, which has come up, I cannot tell you how many times on this program there are going to be congressional investigations regarding Acorn. Why weren't there congressional investigations regarding Blackwater? Eleanor.
Well, I suppose I would go for the Blackwater ones from my ideological perspective. But I think, you know, ACORN has been in the target sites of Republicans for years. And in fact, the whole scandal over the U.S. attorneys and what they were doing had to do with their targeting ACORN. I would recommend an op-ed piece in today's Post by Harold Meyerson, which says what ACORN is, when it was founded, what it does, which has been totally missed in the debate. They've just become this pinata for the right, and they're hard to defend because they do have all these internal financial problems. They've tried to cover them up. But in the great scheme of things, they are such a small player, but it's those small players that become the symbolic things that people grab hold
but
of. And
Steve,
I actually commend the Democrats for having the hearings, because they might have wanted to cover them up, just as the Republican Congress didn't want to investigate Blackwater.
But wait a minute. Steve, in this op-ed piece that you wrote for the Wall Street Journal, you have said there is now a powerful voter backlash against the entire Bush-Obama agenda of bailouts and health care reform and all the rest. And yet, isn't that precisely why Obama was voted in?
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting, because I think Obama kind of misread his mandate. I mean, there was such anger about what was going on in Washington. Look, you know, you had Bush, who the economy collapsed. He was in charge of a very unpopular war. He ran a very effective campaign for change. The problem is, I think a lot of people, Americans, are looking at this saying, I'm not sure this is the kind of change that we wanted. I don't think we wanted to bail out the auto companies. I don't think we do want to, you know, government take over
but
the healthcare system.
But yet they took advantage of the cash for clunkers.
Right. I did. Yeah. I mean, look,
exactly
the government gave
me
$3,000 for a car.
It's people, it's somebody else's dollar is wasted, mine is not. And it's very difficult to get people to
overcome
that. Bruce,
that's not it, though. I don't think that's it.
It is true.
Look, people do think that other people's stuff. But I do think there is a – if the Republicans – I think they're missing the mood here. If they were to come out for, you know, dramatic cuts across the board in government agencies, I think you'd see huge amounts of support for that. I mean, and the major reason is they don't want $9 trillion of new debt. They understand we can't afford it.
That's all language. Cut this, cut that. When those cuts – hit home, you're going to get a very different reaction. And look, President Obama ran on health care reform, on energy independence, education reform. He was then handed another agenda, and that was to rescue the nation's financial system, if not the global system. He had to deal with that. He wasn't going to give up what he ran on. And I must say, the ideological divides in Washington are so stark, but occasionally I was at an energy summit sponsored by the Council on Competitiveness yesterday. It's going on today as well at the Mayflower. Newsweek is the chief media co-sponsor. Lots of CEOs, lots of people. I actually sat next to the gentleman, James Connaughton, who was President Bush's environmental advisor. He kind of laughed and reminded me that Newsweek took a shot at him, saying that he came from the asbestos industry. He said he actually defended asbestos victims. I don't know. But he's there in favor of cap and trade. The ideological lines seem to vanish when people really confront the problems that we face.
And if I could add, Diane, I was with Reagan. He came in, he said he's going to abolish the Department of Education. It's just a waste. He flinched.
Right.
That happens over and over again. It's easy to campaign, but then when it gets to their program, it's going to be cut. They balk, and that's why the government doesn't get cut. I don't care what
but
the rhetoric is.
But there are times,
when
Bruce.
It comes, where is the time?
There
that
are times. Well, it happened in the early Reagan years where they actually cut spending. I was there. I worked for Reagan too. And if you look from 80 to 84, there were cuts in domestic spending. Defense went up, and actually the budget went down in the first couple of years of the Gingrich Revolution as well. I mean, there were cuts. We had the shutdown of the government. Look, I mean, these programs are popular, but Americans do understand you just can't keep passing the bills
all
on
right,
the future generations.
Steve, I find myself wondering whether this whole thing, this anger against government, has been framed in the way Frank Luntz informed Republicans they ought to frame it, namely by saying the government is taking over health care.
Yes.
That phrase
yes.
becomes the thing that so frightens
yes.
Americans that they don't realize the extent to which government is already taking care of them.
Well, it's not a new argument either. I remember the jackbooted government agents were going to come after you. Michael Dukakis proposed hiring more IRS agents in order to collect billions of unpaid taxes. And the first President Bush campaigned and said we were going to have IRS agents under our kitchen table. And suddenly, nobody likes the IRS.
So
that was a real scary prospect.
So framing the debate that becomes really an issue when pollsters go in and ask questions. Those phrases tend to reverberate.
Yes, because the predisposition was there. We found 86% saying the government should do more to increase access and affordability of health insurance, of health care, back in April. But 46% then went on to say, I'm concerned about too much government control of the healthcare system. So it's there, and it's a very effective tool. I want to address one thing, if I have
sure.
a second. I'm very skeptical of the notion that we're in the middle of seeing a significant swing in the pendulum. What's happening here is what I would term leadership anxiety, and we've seen it before. A president comes in who's associated with a liberal position about big government, and that in and of itself creates anxiety. Back in 81, we had exactly the same thing, but in the other direction. Reagan's ratings began to slip in September of 81, and one of the major concerns was he was cutting government too much. Mm-hmm. The American public has a great desire to push things to the middle. They don't want to see things go too mm-hmm. far to the left. They don't want to see things go too far to the right. Now, with respect to Eleanor's point, if the president is a winner and can prove that his point of view on government or anything else has worked, well, then he gets people to change their mind to some extent, as Reagan did. If Obama can prove that he's successful, he'll change attitudes over the long run. He hasn't done it yet.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And on that very point, Bruce, you were there with Reagan. The question is, can Obama become that great communicator who helps people understand what government really does for
them? Well, I think any president can, because he's the one unifying point that all Americans look up to. He can command. He can go on 5 TV shows on the weekend. This is something that even Britney Spears couldn't do in her most debauched moment. So that there's certainly the opportunity to use it as the bully pulpit. And it's really a matter of whether you want to display leadership, irrespective of party concerns, because I think the people are pretty smart. They know whether you're playing to your base as opposed to wanting something good for the country. And I think there's one thing that can be done. You can demagogue an issue. People are not fully informed, and politicians oftentimes exploit that. People don't know, so they use symbols like you say, oh, the government's taking mm-hmm. over health care, like it isn't involved already. It's a matter of degree, like everything else in life. Or politicians can say, you know, it's really not my party. What ultimately makes us a great country is that at those times in the life of the nation, we put the country ahead of winning elections, even if we may lose for a time. And you need to try to change people's minds for good or for ill, whether it helps your party or not.
Steve.
You know, I agree with the point you were just making about the nation doesn't like radical change in one direction or another. We've had radical change to the left in the last year. I mean, think about this, Diane, because the stock market collapsed almost exactly a year ago. What have we done? We had a $700 billion bailout for the banks. We had an $800 billion absurd fiscal stimulus plan. We've taken over the ownership of the Chrysler and General Motors. We had a cash for clunkers program. Now we're talking about a massive new increase in government spending and healthcare. This is a pretty radical left agenda, and I think that's exactly the point you're making.
Launched by a Republican president.
I'm not making a partisan point here, Eleanor. You're exactly right.
Right.
It started under Bush, and Obama came in and promised change, and he's just doubled down on what Bush did.
A lot of people who didn't support Bush supported right. him in that because
right.
they made the case that the economy
right.
was on the brink.
And they were wrong.
Frankly, well,
I don't know that they were wrong. Where are all the jobs?
Wait a minute. You're saying that the economy was not on the brink?
No, I'm saying that I think we'd be in better shape today if we hadn't done all of these interventions. And, you know, look, we were sold an $800 billion stimulus plan that was supposed to create 2 million jobs, and we've lost 3 million jobs. So there's no evidence that the stimulus has worked whatsoever.
Well, there's another argument, at least as valid, saying that letting Lehman Brothers fall created the domino effect.
And this is the same argument happened over the New Deal program.
There will actually be a commission that will go and study all this that's being headed by a Californian.
But this is not new. The New Deal program, we're still debating today. With Roosevelt's programs, where they just panaceas, and we still had 19% unemployment going into World War II. And so the problem here is that you don't get answers like Euclidean geometry. It's guessing what would have happened if something didn't happen. Sure. Anybody can argue that point one way or the other. You could say, well, we would have more bankruptcies or fewer if we had less bailout. We would have turned around faster. And so this ends up being an ideological position rather than scientific.
Except we have pretty good evidence that fiscal stimulus plans have never worked.
It's also indisputable that FDR restored faith and confidence in government and leadership, regardless of where you stand.
All right. Eltner Clift of Newsweek, Bruce Fine, Andrew Kohut, Stephen Moore. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, it's your turn to weigh in on the subject of the federal government. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. From Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And by PBS, presenting The National Parks, America's Best Idea, from filmmaker Ken Burns, premiering Sunday night at 8, 7 Central on PBS. This is NPR.
In real life, they were tabloid sensations. In a new novel by E.L. Doctorow, their story becomes a 20th century epic, a fictional account of New York City's most famous pack rats, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And as we debate the role of the federal government, particularly now under the new Obama administration, let's go first to Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Marilyn. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Oh, Marilyn, I'm afraid your phone is not working well. Can you call us back on a landline, please? Now to Miami, Florida. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Diane. I love your show.
Thank you.
2 points. First, I just wanted to discuss basically the hypocrisy of the conservatives in this country to draw the line of all the socialist things that go on in this country, to draw the line at the most basic human need, which is health, to children and the like. I mean, we have infrastructure that's paid on a communal basis and the military and everything else. And to draw the line there, I just think it's sad and it's ridiculous for people that espouse so much morality onto everyone else to draw the line there.
All right. Stephen Moore.
I think the argument isn't about whether we're going to cover more people with health insurance. It's a question of how we're going to do it. I just had breakfast this morning with John Mackey, the president of Whole Foods. They have an excellent health care plan. That stresses wellness, that is a high deductible plan that is very inexpensive. If you had interstate health care, you could lower costs dramatically. So there are a lot of things that you can do to make health care less expensive, medical malpractice reform, that don't involve a government-run system.
Here's an email from Tom. He says, please ask each of your guests to name one thing that they feel the government does well. I'm going to start with you, Stephen.
Take me last.
No, I'll start with you.
All right. I think the government runs the defense system pretty well. It keeps us safe. I think that the Homeland Security anti-terrorism effort has been expensive. But the fact that we haven't been hit by terrorists for 8 years is a great achievement of government.
All right. Andy.
I won't give my opinion. I'll give the public's opinion.
Okay.
Social Security. When Bush wanted to privatize Social Security, there was a tremendous backlash because people thought he was going to wreck it. 80% of the people that we questioned said, this is a darn good program, and we're very concerned that by privatizing it, we're going to wreck this wonderfully run government program.
And think about how he would have privatized it.
And it was a very modest proposal. It was just allowing younger people to put a portion of their...
Into the stock market.
Into the stock market. But people saw that as a threat to a program that they like.
Bruce, I think it's the system of federal justice, the United States Supreme Court and the federal courts. I think it's the most precious asset, the jewel in the crown of the United States that really makes our property and our liberties secure, makes the country worth staying with. And despite its flaws, I think the court system and the Supreme Court remains the most cherished among all our institutions.
I'll nominate basic research. It was government research that basically launched the internet. And the National Cancer Institute does basic research on marine life around the world to try to see how that can be translated into medicines. The pharmaceutical companies long ago gave up on that because it's too uncertain and too costly, and they're looking for the next billion-dollar drug.
All right. So clearly, the federal government is involved in our lives in many, many ways that serve the American public. Let's go to Kirtland, Ohio. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your program. What really concerns me, and I'd like comments from your guest on this, is the vitriolic language and attacks upon Obama vis-a-vis the government by the right wing. And I didn't see this type of language and so-called tea parties during the past 8 years under the Bush administration when he was involving us in an illegal war in Iraq, a questionable war in Afghanistan, and a complete breakdown of our economy over that 8 year period. This is what really concerns me: these angry attacks by the so-called Tea Partiers upon a man who's been in office less than 8 months.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. Bruce.
Well, with regard to the latter point, the Democrats they knew what Bush was doing and largely supported either expressly or by tacit acceptance. That's why the vitriol wasn't there. They were in part complicit themselves. But I certainly discountenance this idea of violent language. The whole idea of democracy and speech is to have ideas and persuasion, the lodestar of where we go. And it's really quite uncivil and a little bit unseemly for this to become the norm for communication. It creates an intimidation effect out there and suggests those who have the loudest voice rather than the wisest ought to prevail.
Steve.
I've been to a lot of these tea parties and a lot of these town hall meetings. I agree with Bruce. I don't think people should be disruptive. As a conservative, I've spoken on college campuses and been shouted down by students and professors. And so I believe in free speech. But I think this is a character characterization of what's happening. The vast majority of the people who were out on the mall last week, and there were hundreds of thousands, not tens of thousands, these were good patriotic Americans waving the flag who are just concerned about the direction of America. And, you know, when people came out in droves for Barack Obama, nobody talked about mobs and things like that. When people were talking about, you know, George Bush being a war criminal and things like that, I mean, this kind of language occurs both on the extreme left and right. But
Steve,
I think to say that these people are carrying swastikas and things like that is to really be offensive to people who want to participate.
A number of them were carrying
swastikas. But a tiny percentage of them. And those were the LaRouche people, by the way.
Have you really been shouted down by professors?
Yes. Yeah. Right down the street at Trinity College.
A professor shouted you down.
Actually, the professors are much worse than the students.
Well.
They are.
I'm wondering what you were saying.
Andy.
Professors had that in them.
Part of the emotion, both the legitimate emotion and the stuff that goes too far, has to do with feelings of lack of power, feelings of powerlessness among conservatives. They don't feel they have leaders. They feel that this is a new administration and that has a Democratic Congress, and they're not accustomed to being in this position without strong leaders and without having some control on the levers of government.
All right, to Manchester, New Hampshire. Good morning, Sandra.
Hi. I'd like to pose a question, kind of the reverse. What would our nation look like if we had too small a government? Would we have poisonous food like peanut butter and spinach, poisonous toys for our children that contain lead, bridges that collapse for lack of repair, 30% credit card rates, risky Wall Street, things that cause our economy to collapse, people dying prematurely for lack of money to afford health care?
I think she poses a first-rate question.
I would agree.
How do you respond, Steve?
Well, look, you can't blame the Wall Street crisis on a lack of government. I mean, we have five government agencies that are supposed to be overseeing.
But did they do their job?
They didn't, no. But that's the point. I mean, you know, these are government. We're spending tens of billions of dollars on the SEC, the FDIC, all these agencies, and they fell down on the job.
Why didn't they do their job? Were they hamstrung by the White House?
In some cases, they might have been under Bush, but I think a lot of it was just incompetence.
Yeah. Diane, the government gets involved in many of those areas, whether you have an agency, because the law is going to prohibit any false advertising, any poisoning, or creating a dangerous device. You don't have to have a government agency go into court and sue, for it's a tort. It's a wrong under the existing law. And I think that there's a tendency to either say that you either have to have all government or nothing. I come back, balance. It's matters of degree here. If we go back to the origination of the United States, there are very few of these agencies at all. We didn't find people dying in the street and people in massive numbers. There's certainly going to be those who are ill-blessed by fortune or otherwise to fall into hard times. There are charities, there are other ways to take care of these. It's not like we have a perfect world, but oftentimes in the effort to try to eliminate any conceivable aberration where one person suffers, we end up creating a cure worse than the disease.
Well, charities can barely keep up with what they're doing today when you still have the government involved. The notion that we can rely almost exclusively on charities goes back to an agrarian society. We have a very complicated world today, and we import things. You have to have government keeping an eye on what's coming in, and you have to have governments keeping an eye on corporations, because corporations, as President has said, they're not bad people, but they are out. Their mission is to make profit.
All right,
and you've got to have government oversight.
Let's go to Williamsburg, Virginia. Frank, thanks for waiting.
Thank you. Thank you, Diane. I love your show.
Thanks.
Listen, the discourse has been fascinating with your panelists on there, but my take on this is we have everything but a pragmatic approach to what's going on in this country. And when you mention that Reagan decided to do away with education, I mean, education is a key component. We've forgotten about the social contract. And in order to really take a good look at that social contract, I think it would be enlightening. We've replaced the social contract with quid pro quo. And that seems to be the crux of the problem. That's the nexus of what's going on here. When you look at our legislators and you look at government, there's interest involved that underline every single problem in this country. And it's the social contract has been replaced by the contracts that individuals or entities, particularly corporate America, have with the non-consent of the American people.
It's really interesting that, and, you know, I think Frank raises a good point, and yet the American people, those who vote, continue to elect the same representatives to government.
Yeah.
So they believe that they've got good government individually.
Individually, yeah, and they can complain about others. And Steve, listen, I might like all the voters to vote like you like them to curtail government, but I trust politicians to know what their constituents are going to vote for because their entire business is getting reelected. And the article suggesting that somehow all the politicians have it wrong and they're all running on the wrong themes by promoting these programs, I just think can't be substantiated. I think that the politicians are very, very closely wedded to what's being said. I was up there on the first day of the bailout under Bush in the House when they voted it down. Came in hundreds of emails and faxes. They said no. Then when the voting sentiment turned around because of anxiety, they voted the other way there. So I reject the idea that somehow there's a hidden agenda that all the politicians are ignoring. What we need, in my judgment, is leaders who are going to say, listen, I think it's good for the country, even if I lose my seat, that we do X, and I'm going to stand on that principle.
Andy.
Some of this business about social compact has to go back to the voters themselves. Back in 1965, large majority said, yes, we'll pay higher Social Security taxes to take care of older people. In every question I've seen about how to pay for health care reform, people are very, very unwilling to strongly, yes, we'll do that.
What's happened?
What's
happened?
In part, we're in the middle of a bad economy, but I don't think it's only that. People have an expectation that there's a free ride and there's less willingness to make sacrifice.
Well, 80% of Americans have insurance, and while I think a large number of them are nervous about what they have. They've been turned down by insurance companies. Nonetheless, they have it. And they look at what's being proposed, and they're thinking, how do you pay for this? And you're going to expand this. It's going to somehow cut back on what I have. Again, we're back to self-interest. I thought the president tried to make a good point in his media blitz over the weekend, and that is that what he's proposing and what's being discussed is so in the mainstream of American political thought for the last – I mean – President Nixon had a health care plan that was more liberal and progressive than what's on the table today. So to say that he's fascistic or socialistic or communist, terms that contradict each other and that are tossed around in this overheated political arena, I don't think that serves anybody. I'm all for the First Amendment, but enough.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show.
Diane, could I interrupt and make a
point? Wait a minute. Okay. Let me take Mark in Grand Rapids, Michigan first. Go right ahead.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I think one thing that all of you are missing here, and I have a challenge to both Steve and Eleanor at the end of this question. I think one of the big things out here in the, I call the real world outside the Beltway, is that the government, left or right, Republican or Democrat, and I won't use that evil word anymore, but has intention, and the politicians for the last 15 years or so or more have intentionally told us mistruths and half-truths in order to try to push their policy through. We had it with the Iraq War. We had Bush acting like a conservative, and he really wasn't. But in the Obama administration, incredibly, within just a year, you know, no lobbyists. What do you do, lobbyists? Every bill is going to be published for 3 days. Oh, no, well, not the stimulus bill, because that's so important. We can't have anybody read it, and it has to happen immediately. We see it in health care. He says it's not going to change health care. Nobody believes that. That's an intentional statement of a mistruth, and he knows it. The Republicans, death panels. Okay, that's an overstatement. That's an intentional statement of a mistruth. So what people get is, look, maybe some of these things are good or maybe they're not. We can't trust these guys anymore.
All right.
You know, can I say something
on
that?
For me, one more thing. For me, I would rather not trust somebody who says he wants to do less than to not trust somebody who says he wants to do more.
Okay, so now, what are your questions? What are your questions for Steve and Eleanor, quickly?
Well, I want Steve to say how the Republicans have intentionally, and I won't use the word L-I-E, but I want Steve to say one thing of how the Republicans have intentionally misused half-truths to give us false impressions.
And
I want Eleanor to say how Obama give one or two examples of how Obama has intentionally told us mistruths to deceive the public to try to push his policies.
All right.
Well, the Republicans' big lie was that when they came into office in 2001, when they controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they said they would govern as fiscal conservatives, and they ran up the budget. But this isn't – I think the main point that's being missed here is this isn't – the people who are protesting against big government aren't just Republicans. I mean, a massive number of people who go to those rallies are independents, many of whom voted for Barack Obama, who feel like the big lie was we were going to be fiscally responsible, and we haven't been.
Eleanor.
The last president who called for sacrifice was Jimmy Carter, and I've got a laugh line in speeches for years. He called for sacrifice, and we sacrificed him. Political rhetoric does not demand sacrifice. If President Obama can be faulted on any one thing, it's to suggest that we can have this expansion of health care without anybody's hide being gored.
Right.
That is to me within the parameters of political life. I don't call that mistruths or untruths or
do
whatever.
Do we have a new era of distrust in government that really is destructive?
Well, I don't think it's helpful, but the problem is the government sometimes is worthy of the distrust, like Vietnam. But this is not new. The lies that were told about Vietnam, the lights at the end of the tunnel, the government's right to lie has been around, it's been endemic. It's not healthy, but it can stop if the government stops misstating facts.
Bruce Fine, he's former Associate Deputy Attorney General, Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Andrew Kohut of the Pew Research Center for People in the Press, and Stephen Moore, member of the Wall Street Journal's editorial board. Thank you all. It was so interesting.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.